I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Robert P. Jones, president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, about his new book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. And to learn more, you can go to www.whitetoolong, all one word, whitetoolong.net. On Free Forum, explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, in this case, religion, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. Today's guest writes that white Christian nationalism was prominently on display in the prayers and religious symbols participants carried at the U.S. Capitol insurrection on January 6, 2021, and that it, white Christian nationalism, has become central to the trajectory of the contemporary Republican Party, two-thirds of whom identify as white and Christian. Our two political parties, he goes on, are increasingly animated by two conflicting moral visions of our nation. Is America a pluralistic democracy where all stand on equal footing as citizens, or is it a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians? He believes that that sense of divine entitlement, of European Christian chosenness, has shaped the worldview not merely of white supremacists, but of most white Americans, and thereby influenced key events, policies, and laws throughout American history. The last time a Democratic presidential candidate won the majority of white voters was in 1964, a year before Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Voting Rights Act. To reckon with our treatment of the indigenous and the enslaved, Jones concludes, the question that must illuminate the path forward for us and our children is, how can we meaningfully respond to being beneficiaries of a crime so plain it cannot be denied and so large it can never be fully righted? In his latest book, Robert P. Jones contends that to examine the origins of white supremacy in America, we need to look not just as far back as 1619, the arrival of slavery on our shores, but to 1493, the year Pope Alexander VI issued the Doctrine of Discovery, declaring that God had designated all territory not already inhabited or controlled by Christians to be claimed and exploited by Christians as their new promised land. He shows how the enslavement of Africans was not America's original sin, but rather the continuation of acts of genocide and dispossession flowing from the first European contact with Native Americans. This reframing of American origins explains how the founders of the United States could build the philosophical framework for a democratic society on a foundation of mass racial violence, and why this paradox survives today in the form of white Christian nationalism. Finally, through the stories of individuals and communities navigating America's racial contradictions, he entertains the possibility of a new American future in which we may ultimately fulfill the promise of a multiracial democracy. Robert P. Jones is president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute and co-chairs the National Steering Committee for the Religion and Politics section at the American Academy of Religion. He holds a PhD in religion from Emory University, and prior to founding PRRI, he worked at several think tanks in D.C. and was assistant professor of religious studies at Missouri State University. He writes a weekly newsletter at www.whitetoolong.net, and his books include White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, The End of White Christian America, and his latest, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. Welcome, Robert Jones, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Thursday, January 4th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us, in your words, a bit about how you see your path to the life you lead, the work you do. And feel free to go way back, childhood inspirations, mentors, turning points, moments of decision. And in your case, I think you can dig into this because there is, you know, in reading your book and reading articles and so on, you grew up, you know, in the belly of the white Christian church. And so there's a story there of how you end up writing the books and doing the work you're doing today.
Well, there is indeed a story. Yes, in the terms of my youth, you're wanting me to give my testimony. So I will testify. So I grew up. I am of European descent. I grew up thinking of myself as white in Mississippi for the most part, Jackson. But my people, as we say in the South, go all the way back six generations, really in two counties in Georgia, either Twiggs County or Bibb County, Georgia. In fact, my siblings and I are the first in 200 years on both sides of my family not to live in either Twiggs County or Bibb County, Georgia.
Wow.
So the roots go back pretty deep. And, you know, and even we moved just laterally over to Mississippi and in the deep South. So all places, you know, touching the Gulf of Mexico and part of the former states of the Confederacy and all with that legacy. So I think that has really shaped my understanding of the world and what I do today really immensely. I mean, I was also that kid who grew up, you know, not just nominally connected to Christianity, but I was that kid who was at church like literally 5 days a week, you know, growing up, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You know, we thought of sort of Friday and Saturday as Sabbath from church growing up.
And let me jump in for a second and share just my own shared experience, which is, although born in Massachusetts, I grew up in Florida, Catholic, and as a youth, you know, one of the sort of star altar boys, very much into, as an achiever, going to a Catholic school and belonging to a Catholic parish, you know, I was pretty intensely into the rites, the rituals, the roles of being a young Catholic boy.
Well, it sounds very similar. Yeah, just the Southern Baptist version of that, right? So, yeah, leader in the youth group, that was very much a part of my life. I did go to public school in Jackson, Mississippi, which was finally integrated when I was in third grade. So just going to kind of pause on that for a moment to kind of tell you about that, because it tells you something about the milieu that I grew up in. You know, Brown v. Board of Education's 1954. It's not till 1976 that the Jackson Public School System actually got around to integrating my elementary school. So I was in third grade in 1976.
I'll jump in again. Quickly.
Yeah.
Both of the high schools that I went to, my grade school, my 1 through 8, as it was not integrated. But both of the high schools I attended, one in Jacksonville freshman sophomore year and one in Cocoa, Florida, junior senior, both were integrated in that would be 63 and 64. While I was attending them. And in my case, you can share your case, schools of one of about 2,500, one of about 1,500 integrated with 8 black students.
Mm. Yeah, you know, in my case, it was more substantive than that. So when it did happen, it happened where I think at first year it may have been something like 30% African Americans. But by the time I got in high school, our schools were essentially 50-50. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, so here we are in an integrated high school that's about 50% black and 50% white, and those were basically the two racial ethnic groups there. Mm-hmm. But yet, who was my high school mascot? My high school mascot was a Confederate colonel, Colonel Reb. So we modeled our high school after the University of Mississippi, the Ole Miss Rebels. And so that's who our mascot was, right? So band played Dixie. The cheerleaders ran up and down the field with a Confederate flag whenever the football team scored a touchdown. I mean, that was kind of the milieu, even though the school was integrated. And so I grew up kind of in that environment where these, you know, legacies and living forms of white supremacy were still very prominent And where the church that I grew up with was very much a part of that white supremacist world, and yet never talked and really never talked about any of these issues. And I think it's that it was that dissonance that as I've gotten older, a lot of, I mean, really the last three books I've worked on have all been about trying to unravel this question of, you know, the Christian church, white Christian churches were so enmeshed in this project of protecting white supremacy that it's a real question, you know, where does religiosity, you know, can you even disentangle religiosity from that project of white supremacy in white Christian churches? And so it's really been about this journey of, you know, I'm a religion scholar, sociologist by training. So really using those tools, a very personal project for me. It's like, you know, is there a way to think about where Christian faith ends and white supremacy begins, or are they just, you know, impossibly intertwined?
Yeah. And one thing that struck me was that you say that the dissonance was occurring to you in, you know, in your teen years, let's say, and then you get a Master's of Divinity and a Divinity PhD. What's your thinking, and how is it evolving in that period?
Yeah, well, you know, it was all very late and very, very gradual. Like I said, like I didn't feel a lot of dissonance between going to church on Sunday and, you know, getting in my car that had our school mascot and a rebel flag on the front of it.
Yeah, by the way, I have to say, my Catholic high school, the mascot was the Crusaders.
So, yeah, right.
So, I mean, you know, different era. I mean, they're pointing to a different historical era, but yeah. the same wrongness.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, violence, colonialization, right? Yeah. Colonization, right there. You know, so it really was in seminary that I finally had a Baptist history professor that gave me the straight story about what our denomination. About the genesis story of our denomination. So the Southern Baptist Convention, that's the evangelical denomination which I grew up, which, by the way, is the largest expression of Protestant Christianity in the country still today.
Still today, even with all the ruptures and upsets yeah. that have been going on over the last few years.
Yeah, it still has about 14 million members. It's down from 16 million at its peak, but it still is the largest Protestant expression of Christianity in the country today. But he finally, so, you know, I always thought innocently that the word Southern and Southern Baptist just meant a compass point, right?
Right,
we were
geography.
In the South, they were in the North, we were in the South, and that's why we're called Southern Baptists. And I finally, it wasn't until I was in my early 20s that wow. I finally had a history professor that said, oh, actually, here's the story. And it was, you know, absolutely that that word Southern is was in 1845. It was actually predates the Civil War. That the Baptists in the South declared themselves to be separate because they wanted to be able to appoint ministers who were enslavers.
Wow.
And so the entire point of making a new denomination was to make it a place where enslaving others on the basis of the color of their skin could be considered to be compatible with Christianity and the gospel message.
Right, right. And when you say that it is the largest denomination, you aren't saying Baptist, you're saying Southern Baptist.
Yeah, just right. The Southern Baptist convention is it itself is so
remains
that so that ex- so if you think about that, right, that means that this denomination that has that as its pedigree mm-hmm. and that as its genesis story is today the largest expression
right.
of Protestant Christianity in the country. That trajectory right continues forward. So, you know, that was a shock to the system in my early 20s, and I feel like, you know, that began to kind of create a little crack, you know, in the worldview that mm-hmm. allowed some light to come through.
Yeah, let me just mention one little detail that I found, which was that your grand—I mean, just to again, I'm just fleshing out a little more your youth. Your grandfather was a deacon at the church in Macon, Georgia, and one of his designated jobs was to make sure no black people entered the sanctuary.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is, you know, you're talking about that period, the early 1960s. This is, you know, when this was, when the civil rights movement was beginning to really get off the ground. And part of, you know, one of the, they were talking about, you know, parks and swimming pools and libraries and other places that were segregated. But the other places that many civil rights organizers realized early on was really important was places of worship,
sure,
that were the most segregated places as well. And yeah, and it was you know, it's interesting that it wasn't just a wink, wink, nod, nod,
right,
kind of assignment on Sunday morning. This was, you know, something that the board of deacons at the church like met and decided would be an official duty for one of the church leaders every Sunday morning, was to essentially be a bouncer on the outside of the church to make sure that only white people entered the sanctuary.
Wow. Yeah. I just wanted, just so people could see, you know,
yeah,
it was, if the dissonance isn't showing up, in retrospect, it sure must have.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Before we jump into the book, so you're at seminary, there's an inkling, and then how does that evolve to where you end up writing the types of books you write? And how long is that gap from, your first kind of the shade being pulled back, if you will,
yeah,
to you finally saying, I've got to write about this and taking that on?
Yeah, it's a long journey. It's essentially 30 years,
mm-hmm,
from that first kind of insight into thinking, oh, I've really got to rethink, this world that I've kind of grown up in and inherited of. And it really does take about 30 years. It takes, we're seminary, and I think I was at Emory University for graduate school, doing my PhD there. And I think there also what really opened it up for me was reading the works of Black Christians,
mm,
right, who had very pointed things to say about white Christians that I had never read before. You know, just a couple of examples, Frederick Douglass, in his first autobiography, by the way, which was published the same year that Southern Baptists broke off from their Northern brethren over slavery, has, had his entire appendix to his first autobiography in 1845 is about the church. And he says things like, you know, between the Christianity of Christ and the Christianity of the United States, I see the widest possible difference. And he goes on to say, like, the church bells and the slave owners, slave auction bells chime together. We've had Bibles, slaves sold to raise money to send Bibles, to other parts of the world. And just kind of goes on to cite, you know, the immense contradictions and cruelty justified by Christianity there. You know, Martin Luther King, a letter from Birmingham jail, which, again, I didn't read until my late 20s.
Sure.
Talks about in Birmingham, his target there is not the, racists who are spitting and throwing bricks. His target for that letter is the kind of self-understood respectable moderates,
mm-hmm,
right, in Birmingham. And he just asks incredulously in that letter so eloquently, like, who are these people? Who is their God? You know, and he's talking about their big, expensive religious education buildings and their high spires in the Birmingham skyline. And yet they're nowhere on the fundamental question of justice for African Americans there. And he has this line that I think has stayed with me since then, where he says, like, he talks about these people who are sitting safely behind the anesthetizing power of stained glass windows.
Yes.
I think when I read that line, I mean, it was just like lightning had struck, you know, for me. And I realized, like, that's it. Like, that is the role that Christianity had played in my life growing up. Instead of enlivening my conscience, right, it had served as this kind of anesthetizing force.
Right. There's another line you had that I thought I had written down right in this section, which was about the obliviousness that you grew up in.
Yeah.
Do you know the... Nah, if you can't recall it, that's okay. I remember just writing it down. Oh, that's it. Okay, so you're reading people, you're awakening, and there's this slow, gradual process. Now, there's a point that I mentioned in the bio where you're working in think tanks in D.C. Is this outside of sort of the whole religious arena?
You know, it was connected. So I spent a year and a half where I was the founding director at this enterprise called the Center for Religion and Public Life at People for the American Way Foundation, which was Norman Lear's, the late Norman Lear's organization.
Sure.
And so that was very much about religion and kind of its current role. And this was right after, you know, all the so-called values voters, a moniker came up in the early 2000s. So it was really trying to understand, you know, what was going on, right, with religion, values, politics, culture there. And then did that for a few years and then realized that I really wanted to have a place, an independent place kind of dedicated to the work, which led me to found PRRI in 2009.
Got it. Got it. Oh, I did find a line. You had said, "For most of my life, the enchanting power of the Christian doctrine of discovery has endowed me with a comfortable obliviousness." Okay. So, and at a certain point, I'm not sure what year you wrote the first, but so in one review of the Hidden Roots book, someone said, you know, it's basically a trilogy, though not, you know, declared that way. Can you talk about the evolution through these books, and then we'll get to the latest, The Hidden Roots, White Supremacy, and the Path to a Shared American Future?
Yeah, of course. I think that's right. You know, I always wish I was the kind of person who could think, okay, here's what I'm going to do for the next decade.
Sure.
And, you know, kind of line it all out. So I think it's right to think about these books as kind of an arc. There's three books, kind of an arc together, and kind of in retrospect, I think it's legitimate to talk about them as kind of a trilogy, but I think they just, yeah, I kind of stumbled my way there.
Right, you didn't have the confidence or the ambition to call it a trilogy.
Yeah, or the vision, right?
Yeah,
to call
yeah,
it a trilogy.
Yeah,
I think that's
yeah.
right. So, you know, but the first book, it was called The End of White Christian America. It came out in 2016, and that book was really my looking at demographics. So I really had my sociology hat on for that book, and I was realizing that we had crossed a very significant threshold in American history that nobody was talking about that much, and that is that we had moved really in just the first couple of decades of the 20th century, or sorry, the 21st century, so
yeah.
from 2000 forward, we had moved from being a majority white Christian country, which had been kind of the default demographic reality in the country for almost history, one that was no longer a majority white Christian country. So we had gone through this sea change in the country that we really weren't talking about that much and hadn't been recognized that it really changed the kind of cultural and demographic realities in the country, that we had moved just in the first two decades of the 21st century from being a country that was a majority white and Christian to one that was no longer a majority white Christian country. And so just to give you the numbers, we kind of go back to even beginning of when Barack Obama, our first black president, was running for president, the country was 54% white and Christian. We go, by the time I wrote the book in 2016, that number had moved from 54% to 47%.
Wow.
So we kind of crossed that majority to non-majority threshold. Today, 42% white and Christian. So that trend has really continued. But I was trying to kind of mark that out as a significant moment in our country's lifetime and to kind of point to it. This is a group, right? White Christians in the country have been accustomed to thinking themselves at the top of the cultural, political power hierarchy in the country. And so to suddenly find
and not just
on
thinking
the other
of
side of that, I think, has
Robert,
quite a shock.
What I was going to say is not just thinking of themselves that way, but that position so totally taken for granted, right? It didn't even have to be thought
yeah,
of.
Yeah, right, just the default.
It was the default. It was their identity. It was the identity of America.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, and I wrote that book actually, you know, using data that was pre the emergence of, you know, that book doesn't mention Donald Trump. So it comes out before he's really on the scene there. But I do think it describes the stage fairly well that he walked onto.
Now I saw
and kind of dynamics he was able to manipulate.
Right, an article that I read said, you know, that book was overly optimistic or premature. I'm reminded of the book that came out, God, in the 2000s, you know, the emerging Democratic majority kind of thing, and it was like a demographic inevitability that you know that the right was a lost cause. And how do you respond to someone saying that book was ahead of its reality?
Yeah, no, I certainly have gotten a few snarky emails about that. I have to say. So here's the interesting thing, and it's a little bit of a paradox, because on the one hand, the numbers have continued. That trend has continued, right? So again, when I wrote the book, what I was tracking was the decline of the percentage of white Christians in the country from 54% in 2008 down to 47% in 2015. That number today, though, is down to 42%, right? And there's no group that has declined more than white evangelical Protestants, the group that's like the loudest and most prominent in news reports, right, or the most prominent supporters of Trump. But they have declined over that same time period from being nearly a quarter of the population down to only 13.6% of the population.
And who's
today.
The they in that?
That's white evangelical Protestants, right? Wow. That group that I grew up in, that the Southern Baptists are most representative of. So again, they're only 13% of the population today. That's nearly half of what they were just two decades ago. And yet, I think what has happened is, as they have shrunk, they've gotten shriller, more extreme, and just louder.
Yeah,
right?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, and this is exactly what you're saying, but it's kind of that cornered animal syndrome, right? That when survival, suddenly you look up and survival in quotes is threatened, you change, you become more aggressive, you become more hostile, you become more desperate, and so on. And what's interesting is it links to, and I don't know, we won't have time to track that, but it links to the Republican Party's, I call it sort of their exploitation of some of the weaknesses of the Constitution to produce minority rule, so that 13% has an inordinate impact on the Republican Party, and the Republican Party has a disproportionate effect on America and its policies.
Yeah, that's all exactly right, and I think it's also worth just one addendum I'd add to that is that, you know, white Christians in the South have been very comfortable with minority rule.
Right.
As a principle, right? I think
yes.
We often think, oh, they're abandoning democratic principles, but like we got to remember that. I mean, that was the entire Jim Crow project.
Yes,
was protecting the minority rule of white Christians in the South, and they're carrying that forward into national politics today.
You know, it's funny. You made me laugh when you said that because I talk about minority rule all the time, and I'd forgotten that. Yeah, I grew up in it.
Yeah.
Wow. Let me tell people that you're listening to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking today with Robert P. Jones, president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, about his new book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. And you can learn more at www.whitetoolong.net. Okay, so you've talked about the first book.
Yes. So that's 2016. The second book in this, you know, kind of retrospective trilogy is a book called that I call White Too Long. And the subtitle of that one is The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. So if the first book is kind of a demographic book where I'm really am wearing there's lots of charts and graphs and numbers in that book, tracing the kind of demographic shifts in the country. You know, this next book is really part memoir, really, to kind of, you know, still has, I think, some good social science in it, but it's also really my taking those insights and like saying, okay, well, how does this connect to my kind of personal family life? So I actually do some genealogy and take it back and, you know, and connect it to this history where, you know, for example, I have a family Bible handed down on my mother's side that was printed in 1815. And it tells the story in the genealogical pages in between the Old and New Testament. And it's got about three or four generations of her family, my mother's side of the family, there that tells a story of it's the first family that actually comes down from Virginia to Georgia in the early 1800s. You know, there's free land available if you're people of European descent, because at that time Georgia is forcibly removing the Cherokee Indians from the territory, and making that land available in neat little rectangles of 200 acres for people of European descent, and my family's one of the groups that come down with that, and that's all kind of recorded in this family Bible. And so, you know, but I kind of take that and think, okay, here's this family Bible's been passed down and valued as kind of this treasured family artifact and part of who we are. But really, again, without much interrogation of how that's all wrapped up, of course, with enslaving people, right? So I also have a estate settlement from my sixth great uncle who lines out all the kind of issues in their household, beds, sheep, mm-hmm. you know, and in the middle of all those goods are listed for human beings with mm-hmm. dollar amounts mm-hmm. Out beside them. And this is the same family, right? This treasuring this Bible and this Christian identity.
Sure.
Right.
This is the Bible.
Yeah. And at the same time, enslaving others and seeing no contradiction between those two things. And so it really is my exploration of that journey. And I tell a little bit more of that story of the development of the Southern Baptist Convention and its kind of influence on Christianity writ large in the country in that book going forward, and show, you know, how these ideas of white supremacy are still very much not only just kind of inside of that white Christian world, but still really protected and promulgated by the white Christian world.
Right. And let me just tell people, when you're talking about seeing this ledger with property, including yeah. human lives, if anyone, you know, you may have looked, I'm speaking to listeners now, you may have looked at the 1619 Project, or you may have not, but one place that you will see this evidence over and over again is Finding Our Roots. Skip Gates, Henry yeah. Louis Gates of Harvard's show on PBS, which I find a very fascinating show and one of the places where I go for history kind of crossed with human interest. It's just, but whenever one of the guests is black and they are tracing their family tree, we end up looking at those documents where And in those cases, those human beings in almost all cases have no names. They are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, age, sex, and they are property. And you see these ledgers.
Yeah, and in my case, they actually were named. I mean, that has a different kind of power to it. You know, it reads like one, a woman named Naomi at $450. Mm. Bird, a boy. At $150, like,
wow.
you know, listed in the, and I guess the other thing to say there, just to kind of put a fine point on this, is that, you know, my family wasn't the Gone with the Wind strata, right? The patrician mm-hmm, strata. Mm-hmm. You would think of them today as kind of, you know, a little more than subsistence farmers, 200 acre plots for, and when they added up all of their earthly goods on that ledger, and you convert it to today's dollars, they only added up to about $50,000 of goods mm-hmm. in today's dollars. So not wealthy, and yet
they could afford.
Those four human beings on that ledger made up 70% of the assets.
Wow! You
of
know
their
that
earthly goods.
I have to say, one of the things that years ago I interviewed, and I'm forgetting his name right now, the expert from Berkeley, who made the contention at the time that I was interviewing, and I think it is probably still true, that there are more slaves now in the world than there ever were when you count bondage and that sort of thing with miners, and miners meaning people who work the mines and people who work some of the fishing ships and all of these mm-hmm. things, who are bonded and have no freedom. But one of the things he pointed out was that slaves were more valuable than they are now. Now they are disposable since you do not own them. Mm. But back then, as you point out, this family, 70% of their wealth is in the property of the human beings they own.
Yeah.
While
going to church on Sunday.
Exactly. Exactly. And so then this is the third book. And what was the itch that you scratched? What was the moment when you said, you know, I know what the next one is. I got to sit down and start writing this.
Yeah, I think it was just this historical thread that I realized, like, really with White Too Long, I'd gone back deeply into the 19th century, right, pre-Civil War and leading up to Civil War. But there was this, that, you know, that moment of my family coming down from Virginia and getting free land in Georgia. I had not written much about that at all. And realizing that, oh, you know, we're having a big conversation Black Lives Matter and 1619 Project and around reparations and racial justice, and it's largely a kind of black-white conversation. But there's this whole other conversation that we really have to have that has to include justice toward Indigenous people, and how do those stories connect? They're often, when they're told in silos. Here's Native American history over here and African American history over here, but we don't connect them up. And so part of this book was really about taking the historical thread back further, so further back than the 19th century, even further back than 1619, and trying to figure out, like, really going back to first European contact in the Americas and what's going on there that is still with us today. That was the real question I was trying to answer.
And let me ask you something where I'm sort of delving into your writing and creative and research process. At the point you're phrasing this as a question, at the point at which you're wrestling with this, is it still a question, or have you been turned on to the doctrine of discovery and gone, I know how this all fits together now? Or are you actually, you know what I'm saying? Your own process is, it's like, how do these connect?
Yeah, no, it's actually quite organic, and I think I knew that I wanted to follow that story further back. But at the time, I did not have the doctrine of discovery, for example, in the center of the field of view. Mm-hmm. It was only by reading some, like, Native American scholars like Vine Deloria Jr., wrote Custer Died for Your Sins, for example, that like I was like, oh, that's got to be, that really makes it fit together for me. And that's the story that I really need to tell. And it is indeed telling that, here I am. So I've got a PhD in religion. From a pretty top university in the country. I've got a Master of Divinity. I can't tell you how many religious history classes I've taken over the course of years.
And you've written two books.
And I've written two books. And yet this idea of the Doctrine of Discovery and its centrality is haunting us today isn't firmly in view for me. So it really was about, in many ways, I think that's partly what this book is about. It's writing the book I needed to write to get clarity myself.
Yes, yes. So let me just give people the shape of the book, because we've taken our time to get to it, which is not unintentional. I often say I have conversations with people, not with books, so
yeah, that's great.
That's what we've been doing. But just to tell people the shape of the book is, and it surprised me, the shape of the book is, if you look at the cover even, the hidden roots of white supremacy is against a blue background, and the path to a shared American future is against sort of a purple background. And they are really like two different notions here. One is the one we're just talking about right now, is the role of taking the history back to the doctrine of discovery and the roots of Christian sense of entitlement and superiority. A European sense of entitlement and security, and the path to a shared American future is the story of three, well, let's call them states because they are, but it's really three communities who decide to reckon with their past, and it's Mississippi, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, and of course I don't have to tell you those are all Native American names. And I was surprised when I finally opened the book, having read some commentaries on it, that the meat of the book is really those three communities carving this path forward. Because when you read commentaries about the book, it's mostly about the doctrine of discovery. And I understand why that is, because as for you, this discovery of the doctrine of discovery and its central role is kind of the headline here. So I assume that it's new to many. I was aware, prior to preparing for this, that the church justified conquest by Europeans of non-Europeans, but knew little beyond that. So can you tell that story of how this doctrine emerges and its timing is so crucial and obvious, and then kind of the meaning and how it has stuck with us ever since.
Yeah, great. So essentially, the Doctrine of Discovery is, you know, a name that's given to describe a collection of papal bulls. These are like official letters written from the Vatican by sitting popes. They are often written to in response to queries, to settle disputes, and these are like official rulings by the Pope. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that's happening in the latter half of the 15th century, so from 1452 to 1493, is the Pope is getting a series of queries from the European powers that be because they have stumbled upon these lands that they did not know existed, right, in the Americas. And the fundamental question that the Pope is getting is, like, essentially, well, who has the right to interact with these people? Who has the right to occupy these lands? What rights do these people have that we're bound to respect? And it caused a kind of worldview crisis because there's literally a continent filled with people, or continents filled with people, that just aren't on the map in any way. And it causes a theological crisis, right? And so they appeal to the closest thing to international law that there is at the time in Western Europe, and that is the Western Roman Catholic Church.
And by the way, I think it's worth emphasizing that point that you just made, which is that nowadays we go, oh, the Pope said so-and-so. That's on page 8 of the paper,
yeah,
right? But back then, they were the UN, or they were the...
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
No, that's right. That's the importance of it. I mean, they are the court of appeals, right? To kind of often to political disputes, and so they appeal and they ask this question, like, so what rights do these people have that we have to respect, and you know who gets to go where, and essentially these series of documents are answering that question. And I should also say this, that you know this is all sort of in the Catholic world, but at the time this is the 15th century. There are no Protestants in the world, right? This is before the Catholic-Protestant split.
Right.
There are no Anglicans in the world. This is before the Church of England splits. So the entire Western Europe is essentially Catholic. So this is a kind of unified authority that's given out by the Vatican. But essentially, you know, you could read these documents. They're up at a great website called thedoctrineofdiscovery.org. You can read them in Latin, you can read them in English. But what they amount to is this, that they essentially answer the question about what rights people have with their own question. And so the question that the church poses as the threshold question about rights is the question, are they Christian? And if the answer to that is no, and of course they knew the answer to that question, then a bunch of other things follow. And that is the church then very clearly gives rights to occupy the land, to take their goods, and even spells out, you know, this phrase that's just been seared in my brain now, and to submit their persons to perpetual slavery, right? That's just in the documents itself from the church, giving permission to the kind of European colonial powers to essentially go at it. And the other thing it kind of does is it plays referee between Spain and Portugal, mm-hmm, and draws a line and says, okay, from this line over, you, Portugal, can go at it. And from this line over, you, Spain, can go at it. Don't interfere with each other, but you have, you know, within these realms to go. And that's really the moral compass, right, for the entire colonial project is kind of set there in these documents. And the last one that's the most relevant for the American context is one in 1493 that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. And that date's significant, right? Because it's not 1492,
right,
the year we all learned that Columbus sailed the ocean blue, but it's the year he goes back. And so what he goes back to ask for is more ships, more priests, more soldiers. And he asks for a moral mandate for the colonial project that he wants to embark on. And that's what he gets from the church.
Right. And as you point out, what the church is doing there is it's unleashing a synergy between economic interests and missionary zeal. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and let's not forget that the economic interests were on both sides of the ledger. It wasn't that the state had economic interests and the church had spiritual ones. The church had economic interests at stake here, too, with property, owning slaves, like all of that is like also on the – so it's economic, really, and religious on both sides, mm-hmm, of the ledger. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, as we said already, Robbie has a great background in lots of things, and this is the importance of this and the scope of it and the definitive nature of it, in a way, is a wake-up call. So I just want to talk just a little bit more about it, because you point out that in the 19th century, the doctrine of discovery was used as a precedent to give which gave people a sense of title to land that had not been owned with an official title. And this is how the stealing of the land from the indigenous Americans is justified. Can you talk just a little bit about the role of the doctrine of discovery, and this is going to be news to most people, in American legal history?
Yeah, that's right. One image I want to just briefly mention is, you know, we've all seen these paintings of, you know, the kind of Columbus or Hernando de Soto, you know, where they are like landing on the shore from the ocean or at the side of a river. And what we'll see in those paintings is the planting of a flag and usually the erection of a cross, right, in those paintings. And they're often kneeling in prayer, or there's a kind of religious document being read. And, you know, I always often thought of, oh, well, they're just giving thanks for a safe journey, you know, kind of thing in those paintings. But, you know, those paintings are actually capturing a legal ritual that they had devised, right, by planting the flag and planting the cross. They were literally claiming that, making a legal claim on that land, unbeknownst to the land's occupants, right? And that's really what the Doctrine of Discovery empowered them to do. And this idea that by simply being people of European descent and Christian who, quote-unquote, discovered these lands, right, that in itself gave them a legal claim on these lands, even without the knowledge of the current inhabitants. And that idea, which, as far-fetched as that sounds, right, was very much the legal way that this was adjudicated. And it gets picked up. I was just at a conference, actually, in December, at Syracuse University, because we're at the 100th anniversary of the Supreme Court case that incorporates this into U.S. law, Johnson v. McIntosh, in 1823. And it essentially just refers straight back to this idea from the Doctrine of Discovery, that if they laid claim to this and they, you know, they had the authority of the church to do this, the Supreme Court opinion, like, literally says, like, this right has been asserted, it has not been questioned. And at this point, in 1823, it's really beyond reconsideration. It just is the reality of the law of land.
And, right. This is, if I'm not mistaken, this is 3.5 centuries, after the Pope, makes this, is that with this doctrine, American Supreme Court is still, leaning on it, if you will, and using it to justify, the homesteaders and that sort of thing. We don't have to go into all sorts of things, but there's that crazy thing that Ruth Bader Ginsburg refers to the Doctrine of Discovery in a case. Just quickly tell that one, because it blew my mind.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I mentioned 1823. I mean, that's one thing. But the Ginsburg case is, you know, in the 21st century. And footnote one, on opinion written by her, you know, cites the Doctrine of Discovery as the fundamental basis of property rights in the U.S. And so it's still very much alive and well. It's not something, again, buried in the past, but still very much with us today.
Okay. The last thing I want to say about the specifically the Doctrine of Discovery, though there is much to learn in the book and so on, is that the Vatican earlier this year, 2023, finally repudiated the doctrine, saying that the concepts, quote, fail to recognize the inherent human rights of indigenous peoples. Is it significant that the Pope finally repudiating the Doctrine of Discovery is actually from the Americas?
I think it's significant. And, you know, and Pope Francis has been really, more than any other, you know, pope in modern history, trying to reckon with this part of the church's history. In 2022, he did what he called a penitential pilgrimage to Canada, right, and visited many of the boarding schools where people had been forcibly removed from their homes, indigenous children, and forced to go to these boarding schools in horrendous conditions. And he actually went on a pilgrimage and visited those. yeah, in 2023, he issues a repudiation of the ideas. The only thing I would say that I was a little unsatisfied and disappointed with in that document that came out of the Vatican by Pope Francis is that it doesn't quite fully allow the church to take responsibility. What it ends up saying is the ideas, yes, were wrong, but then it talks about the church's children or other actors who manipulated these ideas and did these things. And if the church is guilty of anything, it's for not or for being silent. But it doesn't really fully say we were wrong.
Yeah. Well, if we've read anybody who's read about the battles that Francis has had just to say what he has said, probably understands there were some backroom dealings.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's significant that it went here.
Yeah.
I still think it has another step to take.
What you're saying is not that necessarily that he didn't go far enough because there were probably constraints, but that the church has yet to go far enough.
Yeah, I mean, the way I put this in kind of colloquially is, you know, if this were an apology I'd offered to my spouse, I think we'd still be talking.
Okay. So the section that actually makes up the center of the book is deals with the second half of your title, as I said, The Path to a Shared American Future. And you focus on Minnesota, Mississippi, and Oklahoma. And it's interesting, you construct each of those sections, the section on each of those, in this way. Before Mississippi, or before Minnesota, or before Oklahoma. So this is the pre-establishment of these states. And then in that before, you point out what happened to the indigenous people. And then you link it to, in the case of Mississippi, the murder of Emmett Till. In the case of Minnesota, lynchings in Duluth. And in the case of Oklahoma, the Tulsa Race Massacre. And then, so we've got, this is what they did to the indigenous, this is what they did to blacks, and then you have, in each of them, commemoration and repair in Mississippi, Minnesota, and Oklahoma. Talk about that, because that is what you hope is the path forward.
Yeah, no, that's a lovely summary. I think that's right. You know, I wanted to get to, in this book too, to kind of turn the corner to that second part of the title, right, and the path to a shared American future, and get to where I see things moving, where I do find some hope. I think it's often difficult, in many of our current moments to see much light. It looks kind of dark, and we see the continued legacy of this other side of American history. But I'll just tell a couple little vignettes that I think are helpful. So I'm from Mississippi, and deeply moving what's going on in Mississippi. In Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, as recently as 20 years ago, if you had gone, driven up and down the roads and the highways in that very rural county, there was literally nothing on the ground to tell the story of Emmett Till. No markers, no things you could stop at, even in the even where the courthouse was, where his trial infamously acquitted his killers in just over an hour's time of deliberation by a jury of all white men. There was just nothing there, and it was really a group of people who, again, with very few resources, a group of white and black local people decided that it was time to tell the story, to tell the truth about that, and to do it in a way that was going to build a different future for their community, that this divide and the silence over it was still a real sticking point in the community. So they begin meeting, this is a very poor county. The county seat only has 600 people, right, who live in the county seat town. And these are also people who, were the descendants of enslaved people and the descendants of enslavers.
Sure.
So their families are connected right back in ways that are very challenging to deal with. And yet they decide to come together to kind of lay a new foundation for the future. They have actually succeeded, and this is not in the book because it just happened last year. Their efforts over 20 years have now borne fruit, in that there is now going to be a new national monument. And so not just local markers in telling the story, but a new national monument that's going to be jointly in Chicago, where Emmett Till was from, and in Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, where he was killed. That's going to be the Emmett Till and Mamie Till Mobley National Monument that'll be under the auspices of the National Park Service. And so they have done something that's not only told a new local story and kind of helped their community heal and get to a new place, but also built a new national story. So this story will be told, you know, at the national level, and will be kind of in perpetuity on the ground. And they're also building, like, there's an Emmett Till Interpretive Center there that runs, like, programs for kind of youth in the area. So it's infused a whole new life into the town and into the county just from the efforts of a group of local people saying it's time to tell the truth. It's time to kind of think about how we can repair this damage and move forward together.
Okay, and I just want to read. I'm going to read three quotes, and then I'm going to give you the final word. And one of the quotes is from Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, designating that Emmett Till National Monument. We can't just choose to learn what we want to know. We have to learn what we should know. We should know about our country. We should know everything, the good, the bad, the truth of who we are as a nation. That's what great nations do. And we are a great nation. And then we got a hell of a long way to go. That's Joe Biden. This is James Baldwin. All that can save you now is your confrontation with your own history, which is not your past, but your present. Your history has led you to this moment, and you can only begin to change yourself by looking at what you are doing in the name of your history. And then Robert P. Jones, there's a kind of liberation, freedom, and growth that can come from facing this history and moving somewhere better together. That's the invitation. Robert P. Jones, a final word, and I hope that people will find this book. As much as the Doctrine of Discovery will be a revelation to you, show in this moment of, you know, confrontation and polarization and so on, will be the examples that Robbie gives of people changing the path we've been on to a path forward.
Oh, well, I love that you brought James Baldwin in here at the end. He's been one of those people. I mentioned Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King Jr., Howard Thurman, others, but Baldwin has been an immense influence on kind of my journey here. And I'll end with a kind of a quote from him. You know, when he was asked in very challenging times, you know, what he hoped for, where he finds hope, and, you know, he would often say, you know, well, you know, yes, things are really challenging. They're very complicated. This is very tough history that we've inherited. But that he would say, but I have faith that we can be and do better. And he would leave it at that. And I think that that's in many ways where I am at too. And those stories of hope from Minnesota, from Mississippi, and from Oklahoma, I think have left me with that place too, that, you know, if these folks can do this on the ground in very difficult places, it gives me some hope that we as a country can also that we can be and do better.
Yeah, that there is a future and it's a better future. Yeah. Okay, let me tell people, I really appreciate this, and I appreciate what I learned in the book as well. The book is The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy, and a shared path, and the path to a shared American future. You can learn more at whitetoolong.net, white too long, and it needs the www in front of it for some reason, but what www.whitetoolong.net. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and links to probably 10 or 15 articles, relevant, timely, and so on, email me at TEMcnally@mac.com, or you can sign up at my website. And you can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and most of those other major podcast sites. Archives include Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. I guess I have to call it X now. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And finally, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Robert P. Jones. Keep up your good work.
Oh, thank you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Super.